excited.
Welcome back to Robbinsdale Revisited, the podcast where we blow the dust off the archives, sort through the stuff, and drag local history back into the light. I'm Crystal Boyd, and I'm a Robbinsdale Historical Society member in good standing.
And I'm Pete Ritchie, and I still smile every time I say I'm still the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Today, we are parking ourselves at 3730 Toledo Avenue North.
Toledo Avenue, the street name that triggers immediate nostalgia for anyone who grew up in District 281 between 1956 and, well, earlier this year, 2026.
That's right. For nearly 30 years, it was the new Robbinsdale High School. Then it shape-shifted into an early childhood learning center, a Spanish immersion program, a technology learning campus, and most recently, Robbinsdale Middle School, which officially closed its doors for good this year. And that might be the end of a very long, storied era.
But before it was a middle school or a Spanish immersion site, it was a massive post-war solution to a chaotic problem, the baby boom that hit Robbinsdale like a freight train.
By 1956, District 24, as it was known back then, was practically bursting at the seams. In just 10 short years, student enrollment quadrupled, and the old high school over on Regent Avenue couldn't hold the influx of teenagers unless they started stacking them vertically.
So the district did what any expanding 1950s suburb did. They broke ground on a massive, state-of-the-art facility right off Highway 100. We're talking about a light brown brick complex costing about $3 million in mid-century money.
When it opened on September 5th, 1956, it was designed for 2,000 students. It boasted 31 classrooms, 6 industrial arts shops, 6 science labs, an 800-seat auditorium, and a gym complex that could seat 2,400 screaming fans.
But of course, you can't spend $3 million in local tax dollars without local taxpayers losing their absolute minds in the letters to the editor section of the newspaper.
In 1956, right before the building opened, a local resident, Lawrence Jen, wrote into the Minneapolis Star complaining about these million-dollar plants with their marble-faced bus-loading areas. He ran the math and figured each classroom cost nearly $100,000, asking if taxpayers were being taken for a ride while property taxes drove homeowners out of town.
Because heaven forbid children stand near marble while waiting for a school bus. And the petty fights didn't stop with the budget. There was an entire feud over the name of the school. Since the school wouldn't be serving just Robbinsdale residents, Mayor Ralph Overly from the city of Crystal pitched naming it Cooper High School in honor of Superintendent E.J. Cooper.
Yeah, Overly over there in Crystal. He was full of ideas, but the superintendent shook his head and the school board kept the name Robbinsdale. Principal Milo Milky stepped up as the inaugural principal, a post he'd held until retiring in 1968, though he stayed so iconically tied to the school that they eventually named the football stadium Milky Field after him.
And Pete, we can't talk about the legend of Robbinsdale High School without bringing up the garage rock explosion that took flight here and shook America.
And you know, for some reason that reminds me of one of my favorite quotes by the great Frank Zappa, who said, "High school is not a time nor a place, it is a state of mind." But we're talking about the Trashmen, Surfin' Bird, the song that hit the Billboard charts in early 1964 and put Minnesota on the global pop map. Then these four guys from Liverpool turned up.
Well, that's them, the Trashmen. Their origin story is hyper-local. Steve Waugh moved up to Robbinsdale from Iowa right before his freshman year. He enrolled at Robbinsdale High School and met rhythm guitarist Dahl Winslow.
And then in 1957, they bumped into lead guitarist Tony Andreasen out at the old Crystal Coliseum during a local team dance, and the rest is rock and roll history. They formed the Citations, played around with local bands like Jim Thaxter and the Travelers, and eventually launched the Trashmen in 1962 with bassist Bob Reed.
But my absolute favorite piece of Trashmen lore comes from Tony Andreasen's childhood friend and the official band historian, Mike Jan. He told this story about him and Tony sitting parked in a 1948 Plymouth on a hill overlooking Crystal Lake so they could boost the radio signal for the Grand Old Opry, which broadcast out of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, so one of our Robbinsdale cops pulls up and asks what the hell two teenagers were doing parked by the lake on a Saturday night, and they had to explain, "Officer, the reception for the Opry is just better up here by the lake. There's less interference." But there was no beer in the car, just two kids obsessing over country licks and guitar boogie.
And a couple years later, Steve Wahr was performing the famous Bird Dance solo on American Bandstand in 1964. He was there by himself because Dick Clark's producers refused to pay to fly the entire band out to the studio.
Ah, the cheapskates. The Trashmen flew from Robbinsdale to international stardom, and it all runs straight back through our city and our high school. A little before my time, I think I remember hearing a cover version by the Cramps in 1978 before I ever heard the original.
And you know, Pete, when you look at the creative powerhouse that was Robbinsdale High School, the Hall of Fame isn't just limited to professional wrestlers and rock stars. We also have to talk about Kathryn Lee Scott.
Yeah, long before she became a household name playing Maggie Evans on the gothic cult classic television series Dark Shadows, she was known as Marlene Kringstad, growing up on a family farm just a few blocks from the high school.
Even back during her high school days at 3730 Toledo Avenue, her natural media instincts were on full display. She wrote for the student newspaper, The Robin's Tale, and get this, she scored an exclusive interview with legendary American poet Carl Sandburg.
So there's a scoop. She snagged an interview with the Pulitzer Prize winner when Sandburg was in town for the dedication of Sandburg Junior High over in Golden Valley.
That sharp writing talent and early flair for performance really set the stage for everything that came next. She took that Robbinsdale work ethic all the way to New York and Hollywood, where she launched a decades-long career as an actress.
And she didn't just stay in front of the camera. She carried out that high school journalism drive into a prolific career as a published author, writing novels, memoirs, and nonfiction books. It all traces back to her roots right here.
Now, Milo Milky and the mid-century administration ran a tight ship. And by tight ship, we mean strict, uncompromising dress codes.
Let's set the scene. Late 1950s and 60s, girls were strictly forbidden from wearing blue jeans or skirts that dared to end up above the knee. Boys couldn't wear jeans either, surfer shirts were banned, and heaven help you if your hair brushed against your shirt collar.
It was the classic keep the youth respectable playbook. But by February 1969, late 60s pushback had finally pulled off Highway 100 and arrived on Toledo Avenue.
On a chilly February morning in 1969, between 100 and 200 high school students staged a coordinated act of mass civil disobedience, their weapon of choice, denim.
They showed up to school wearing blue jeans, and the administration's response was swift, brutal, and a little hilarious in hindsight. Every single student was suspended on the spot.
Imagine suspending nearly 200 kids because of a cotton twill. The local news had a field day, parents were arguing at school board meetings, and the students essentially proved that the dress code was holding on by a thread. Federal court rulings across the country were striking down strict dress codes anyway, so the district eventually threw in the towel and denim conquered Toledo Avenue.
So, Pete, we've been looking through old yearbooks and school newspapers, but you have some personal history with this building. What was it like walking through those doors when you were younger?
It felt massive, but the layout made sense. Unlike the newer suburban schools built later with an open plan and a modular setup, RHS had the classic solid grid. I don't remember ever getting lost.
Did you ever feel like you were walking through a piece of local folklore?
Absolutely. Whenever you were in the gymnasium or looking at the old auditorium stage, you always knew that this wasn't just some standard suburban school. You'd hear stories from older relatives and neighbors about championship football games, cheerleaders, kids that were cooler than you would ever hope to be, and legendary keg parties down in what is now Sohocki Park. I might have made it to a couple of those myself.
I knew it.
And of course, the wrestlers. We all knew somebody or knew somebody who was cousins with at least one professional wrestler that graduated from Robbinsdale. You couldn't escape the athletic aura of the place.
Well, what about your own memories of the district?
Oh man, back in 1980 when I was a sixth grader, they cast me and a few other boys whose voice hadn't changed in The Man Who Came to Dinner. Acting on that stage with the heavy curtains and the stage lights beaming down, you felt the weight of every performance that had ever been since 1956. They brought us out in little choir robes, and there was this chaotic scene where all the other characters were in a tizzy about how to get the dinner ready, who was coming, and we just came out and sang this little song. But it was really fun being backstage. The cast of every play had left graffiti on the backstage walls.
How about the weekends? What did you do on Friday nights?
Friday night football at Milky Field was the undisputed center of the universe. The band playing, the stands packed to capacity, the cold autumn air. There was nothing like it because all the junior high kids would go. I don't remember actually ever watching a game, but you could go to the game and you could find out where the keg parties were in the woods. And then you could go down to the party afterwards. If you got lucky, you could be under the stands making out with some high school girl and come home with a hickey on your neck. And then your mom would give you a long talk about how you have to be careful with girls under the stands at the football game. So yes, Robbinsdale High School was legendary and everybody in the neighborhood had a story. And of course, everybody went there.
Good. Okay. Yes. Legendary. Absolutely.
On the flip side, I also had the privilege of experiencing the building in the summer because my mother thought she couldn't have me sitting around the house all day. I had a paper out, but I didn't have enough to really keep me busy. I didn't have a job. So she says, well, why don't you sign? You're going to sign up for some classes over at the high school. I don't think that she realized that if I signed up for classes like biology or home ec, and even gymnastics, I would be in the high school with people that flunked those classes. So I go into the biology class and the teacher gives a long lecture about how we're all here because we want to get credit so that, you know, we can graduate from high school. Then I'm sitting there thinking, but I'm not taking the class for credit. And they dragged us out to this little pond between the high school and Highway 100 and the Schley Bowl. And we were going to look at the pond scum and all the things floating around in it and take a little sample. The moment we get to the pond, everybody lights up cigarettes. And the teacher is just fine with it. So all these guys are sitting there smoking. And I'm like in eighth or ninth grade. And I'm thinking, well, can I bum a cigarette? So I learned to smoke at summer school. That was kind of cool. The home ec class was sort of a similar scenario. Here's all the people that flunked home ec. And here's grade Pete with all the high schoolers. But I idolized all these kids. They were 3 or 4 years older than me. And I was making notes about what they were wearing. Look at those shoes. Those are really cool. And there was sort of a new wave thing. The gymnastics class was great. We did a lot of stretching. I learned how to stretch. I learned to hate stretching. Mr. Craig was the teacher who I later had as an art teacher in high school. And he still shows up at the Robbinsdale class reunions. Of course, they closed Robbinsdale High School the year before I got there, and we'll talk about what a miserable battle that was and how we lost. I always thought I would be going to Robbinsdale High School, and I had that special preparation for it in that summer when I was in junior high. But let's circle back to the wrestlers, Crystal. If you polled random people across the country and asked them where the global epicenter of professional wrestling was in the 1980s, what would they say?
Well, they'd probably guess Atlanta, Calgary, maybe New York, and they would be dead wrong because the real answer is 3730 Toledo Avenue North in Robbinsdale, Minnesota.
It was an absurd statistical anomaly. No single high school in human history has produced more legendary Hall of Fame professional wrestlers than Robbinsdale High.
And Pete, I'll let you run through these, but we have 8 guys in the Hall of Fame lineup who walked these exact hallways, ate the same cafeteria mystery meat, and lifted weights in the Toledo Avenue gym.
Yeah, maybe that mystery meat is the common denominator that brings it all together. But Vern Gagne, class of 1943, the godfather of Minnesota professional wrestling, 2-time high school state champion, NCAA champion, and multi-time AWA world champion back at the original Regent Avenue High School. Larry the Axe Hennig, class of 1954, the 1954 Minnesota State Heavyweight Wrestling Champion, AWA Tag Team Champion, and Absolute Powerhouse. Kurt Hennig, class of 1976, Larry's son, famously known as Mr. Perfect, AWA World Heavyweight Champion, WWF International Champion, and widely considered one of the technically greatest wrestlers ever to step inside the ring. Ravishing Rick Rude, class of 1976, WWF Intercontinental Champion and WCW World Heavyweight Champion, complete with the airbrush tights, the iconic mustache, and the legendary swagger. Tom Zink, class of 1976, the Z-Man, RHS soccer player turned Minnesota bodybuilder, WCW television and tag team champion. And his dad was Bob Zink over at North Drug, who I used to work for, and you didn't want to mess with Bob either. Dean Peters, class of 1976, RHS gymnastics captain, who took his high-flying athleticism into the WWF as Battle Cat Brady Boone, John Nord, class of 1977, star RHS wrestler and football player who became Nord the Barbarian in the AWA and the Berserker in the WWF. Barry Darso, class of 1978, RHS football and hockey star, best known as Smash from the legendary three-time WWF World Tag Team duo Demolition, also known as the Repo Man. So you look at those grad years, 1976, 1977, 1978, Kurt Hennig, Rick Rude, Tom Zink, Dean Peters, John Nord, and Barry Darso were all in the building at the exact same time. Can you imagine walking down the hallway in 1976 and bumping into Mr. Perfect and Ravishing Rick Rude arguing near their lockers? The sheer amount of machismo and bravado in those halls must have been off the charts. Trained locally in church basements and gyms by legends like Ed Sharkey and Vern Gagne, these guys went on to dominate Vince McMahon's WWF and Ted Turner's WCW. Throughout the 80s and 90s, Robbinsdale was literally the birthplace of modern sports entertainment.
But Pete, you forgot Medusa. Deborah Maselli attended Robbinsdale High School in 1979, and she went on to achieve legendary status across both professional wrestling and motorsport. After debuting in 1984, she earned early fame in the American Wrestling Association, or AWA, as Medusa Maselli, winning the AWA World Women's Championship in 1987. And in 1988, she won the PWI Rookie of the Year, the first woman ever to win that award. Then in 1989, she broke new ground by becoming the first non-Japanese wrestler to sign with All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. She transitioned to WWF as Alundra Blaze in 1993, where she captured the WWF Women's Championship three times before famously returning to WCW in 1995, where she dropped the title belt into a trash can on live television. Then, during her later WCW tenure, she made history as the first and only woman to win the WCW Cruiserweight Championship before retiring from in-ring action in 2001. But wait, there's more! Maselli then launched a standout second career in monster truck driving. She won the Monster Jam World Finals Championships in both freestyle and racing with her signature Medusa truck. And I saw her when I went downtown to downtown Minneapolis at the Metrodome for the Monster Truck Jam. It was just amazing to see her out there crushing it. So capping off her trailblazing sports entertainment legacy, she was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2015 under her moniker of Alundra Blaze.
You know, I heard a great quote from her once, that it was, the difference between driving a monster truck and wrestling was in the monster truck races, you didn't know who was going to win. You know, it seems to me she also had a role as Rick Rude's valet, but I don't think she graduated from RHS. I don't know if she dropped out or moved. I can only find her in one yearbook.
It doesn't matter. She's the most amazing. She belongs at the top of the list of all those amazing Hall of Famers.
Okay.
Well, while our alumni were becoming international superstars, back home in District 281, a massive economic and demographic storm was gathering.
Yeah, the late 1970s brought a harsh reality. The baby boom had long ended, and district-wide enrollment cratered, dropping from 28,300 students in 1971 to down around 16,300 by the 1981-82 school year.
The math was cold and unfeeling. State funding plummeted along with enrollment, and the district simply had too many high schools. They had already shuttered seven elementary schools and a junior high, so now it was a high-stakes three-way standoff between Armstrong, Cooper, and Robbinsdale High Schools.
Robbinsdale High was actually the cheapest school to operate in the entire district, but Armstrong was located out west in the fast-growing, more affluent Plymouth, and it featured a media center, a modular scheduling setup, whereas RHS sat on the eastern edge of the district in an older neighborhood.
The school board meetings turned into absolute battlegrounds. We're talking about packed auditoriums, screaming matches, months of political deadlock. The city of Robbinsdale fought tooth and nail to save its namesake high school. In early 1982, over 300 students walked out of class to march in protest.
Yeah, and the board deadlock was so severe, stuck in a 3-3 tie over whether to close Cooper or Armstrong, and then on January 18, 1982, they pulled a radical parliamentary maneuver. They formally proposed closing all three high schools to satisfy legal requirements and handed the real decision over to a private three-member fact-finding panel consisting of former Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice Robert Schurin, James Hetland Jr., and John Mass.
A fact-finding panel. That's interesting. So the panel met behind closed doors, and they accepted no direct public input. They ultimately recommended keeping Armstrong and Cooper High Schools while shuttering Robbinsdale High School. In April 1982, the board voted 5-1 to adopt the panel's recommendation and close Robbinsdale High School at the end of the term.
Outraged parents and citizens immediately filed lawsuits against the board alleging widespread violations of the Minnesota open meeting law. A local district court judge agreed, finding board members guilty of 14 separate meeting violations stemming from secret phone calls and small group meetings, fining each member $100.
That fight went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1983 in the landmark case Moberg versus Independent School District 281. The Supreme Court reversed the personal fines against the board members. They ruled that discussions between fewer than four members didn't constitute a formal quorum, but they ultimately upheld the school closure, ruling that the district acted within its legal authority.
The final graduating class walked the stage in June 1982, officially ending an era of Robbinsdale Robbins. But if you really want to feel the raw emotion of that moment, you have to turn to the students themselves. The final issue of the Robbins Tale, published on June 4th, 1982, serves as an incredible, poignant farewell to the school.
And that paper was practically a historical archive written in real time, and the student journalists did not hold back. They captured the heavy emotional fallout, including the anger and the heartbreak. It brought together personal reflections from students, teachers, and staff facing the end of an era. Senior spotlights highlighted the resilience of the class of 1982 as they prepared to walk out the door as the last official graduates.
But it wasn't just a sad goodbye. It was a massive celebration of the school's identity. A huge portion of the final issue focused on the legacy of Robin Athletics. They paid tribute to Coach Irv Nerdahl and his legendary 31-year tenure leading Robbinsdale football to 11 Lake Conference titles. The paper detailed all those Friday night victories and the intense rivalries that brought the whole town together.
They covered the powerhouse wrestling team with its 8 state titles and 50 individual champions, plus the gymnastics program that put Robbinsdale on the regional map. They captured all the everyday memories, like favorite teachers, pep fests, theatrical productions, and cafeteria culture. The editorial staff made sure to emphasize that while the building at 3730 Toledo Avenue was closing, the community's bond would endure.
It stands as the definitive capstone of 26 years of history on Toledo Avenue. Let me read a piece directly from the sports section of the final June 4th, 1982 issue. For decades, Friday night at Milky Field was the undeniable pulse of this community. Under the leadership of legendary coach Irv Nerdahl, Robin football wasn't just a high school sport. It was a local institution that defined toughness, teamwork, and town pride. From packed bleachers echoing the fight songs to grueling practices on cold autumn afternoons, generations of athletes learned what it meant to carry the Robbinsdale name. Beyond the gridiron, our powerhouse wrestling and gymnastics programs consistently proved that small-town spirit could dominate state-level competition. As the lights on Milky Field dim for the last time, the records may fade, but the legacy of Robin Athletics will remain unbroken.
And here's a snippet from the main editorial page written by the student staff as they closed out the paper. Writing the final chapter of a 26-year story is no easy task, especially when these light brown brick walls on Toledo Avenue have held our entire world. We spent this final year navigating a storm of school board debates, walkouts, and uncertainty, yet our identity as Robins never wavered. Walk down these corridors today, and you won't just hear the echo of closing lockers. You'll hear the ghosts of pep fests, play rehearsals, and quiet moments between friends. The district may be shuttering the doors of 3730 Toledo Avenue, but they cannot erase the memories created within them. To the faculty who guided us, the athletes who inspired us, and the class of 1982 who stood strong to the end, we thank you. The building may close, but the spirit of Robbinsdale High School will live on in every single one of us.
Yeah, let's hope so. The electoral retaliation was wild, too. In May 1982, right after the closure vote, over 19,000 Robbinsdale voters turned out and swept three pro-RHS candidates, David Southward, Patricia Norby, and John Schaefer, onto the school board. But even with the new majority, an estimated $4 million cost to reverse course and reopen the school was just too steep, so the decision stood.
A Minnesota poll taken in July 1982 showed just how deeply split the area was. In Robbinsdale, 73% of residents thought closing Robbinsdale High School was a terrible decision. But out in the Western Armstrong area, 64% thought it was a good decision. So it was a total geographic divide between the old town center and the new expanding suburbs.
But as we know, 3730 Toledo Avenue refused to fade away. Over the next four decades, District 281 adopted the space for early childhood education, the district's technology learning center, a Spanish immersion program, and eventually, in 2005, it became Robbinsdale Middle School.
It continued to educate thousands of local kids for decades until closing its doors for good earlier this year in 2026. The physical functions of the building may change, but the history built inside those brick walls on Toledo Avenue remains an unforgettable chapter of our town.
I can't remember the tune for this, but I'll try a dramatic reading of the Robbins fight song. There's a yell from the students and the teachers as the team goes marching by. There's a cheer from the stands and the bleachers as they play to do or die. At the half, you can tell the gang came. We have a team that cannot fail. Who's the winner of this bargain? It's good old Robbinsdale.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. And bus back home sitting hand in hand when the evening ends. When the evening ends. When the evening ends. In Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.
From Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, May 1924.
Dear Captain, is it quite proper for a lady to let her husband look at her whiz bang? From Lotta Ginger.
Quite right, we'd say, providing, of course, that it's Captain Billy's.